The Democratic National Convention is officially underway in Philadelphia. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight, live from Talk Show Row inside the Wells Fargo Center. Now, just a couple of hours out from the start of the primetime speeches, let's bring in WHYY's Dave Davies a few levels up overlooking the convention floor. Now, Dave, just a couple of days back, you were in Cleveland for the Republican convention, now in Philly with the Democrats. What differences strike you?
It's a lot hotter here, Dave, and I don't mean just the weather. You know, there was tension in Cleveland and the hall at times and an undercurrent of discomfort among delegates about the party's nominee, but the differences here among Democrats are much more open, much more vocal, and often downright hostile. You know, when I was working my way through these security areas on the way to the arena, just on the other side of a temporary hurricane fence, there were a bunch of Bernie Sanders people just yelling at those headed, and here's a bit of what that sounded like. Now, that was the more civil part of what we heard. People were yelling at me, calling me corrupt because they saw credentials around my neck and assumed I was a Clinton delegate. It was pretty hostile.
Dave, this has to be of concern to the Clinton campaign. I'm sure they wanted a much more unified presentation. Have you had a chance to tap into the mood among the Pennsylvania delegates?
Yeah, I spent some time at their morning caucus, and the state chairman, Marcel Groen, began the breakfast by asking Sanders delegates to stand, and Clinton delegates gave them a very warm round of applause. You know, I spoke to Congresswoman Allison Schwartz and other Clinton delegates, and their message was that the Sanders people had accomplished a lot, had done great things for the party, and we welcome that, we appreciate it, and we want them in the fold, working hard for the ticket that will defeat Donald Trump.
Okay, now how about the Sanders delegates?
Their attitudes are all over the place. You know, I saw John Fetterman, the 6'9" mayor of Braddock, Pennsylvania, who ran for governor last year. He heartily endorsed Sanders early. His wife is a Sanders delegate here, but he said it's time to support the ticket. He said he's telling people if you're not voting for Hillary, you might as well put on a Make America Great Again hat because you're helping Trump. Another one I spoke with, Ann Kirby from Lancaster, referred to those emails about the Democratic National Convention Committee favoring Clinton. She says the system is looking pretty rigged to her. She's actually considering voting for Green candidate Jill Stein, just taking it all in. And here's another guy I spoke with, a very committed Bernie supporter from Lancaster. His name is Jonathan Fox. And he said, by the way, he said he was happy to talk to me because I was from public radio. He would not speak with what he called the corporate media. He said he is ready to back Clinton, but others just aren't there yet.
I want them to go through what I call a grieving process to get to the point where they accept that Bernie will more than likely not be the nominee and then work it from there. And that's where the Hillary Clinton campaign needs to come in and not lecture us, but instead give us good reason why she is the better candidate as opposed to Trump.
Yeah, I thought that notion of grieving was interesting. You know, he says
I
Bernie
want
supporters
them to go
who have,
through.
Who those that Bernie supporters who have worked so hard have to process this change, and that if they don't come to support Clinton genuinely, organically, in their own way, it's not going to be real and it won't be effective.
Dave, as I'm sure our listeners can hear in the background, it's pretty lively here at the Wells Fargo Center. It's just getting underway. Can you sense the mood and how it might play out on the floor?
You know, it doesn't look like a happy family at the moment. I mean, the stuff so far has been pretty routine, but the Sanders supporters have jumped at every opportunity to chant their candidate's name, and the Clinton folks have tried to shout them down at types. There are sometimes boos when Clinton's name is mentioned at the podium. It doesn't feel good-natured. You have the sense that Sanders people feel betrayed, both inside and outside this arena. Of course, later we're going to hear Sanders speak this evening, and maybe once these delegates have had a chance to cast their votes and raise their voices, the tone will change. We'll just have to see how it all unfolds.
And before Sanders speaks, Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney is supposed to take the podium. Any idea what he's going to say?
Yeah, it's going to be very brief remarks, not in prime time, the kind of podium time you get typically as a courtesy. I'm told he's going to talk about the anti-Irish rights in Philadelphia, the 1840s, and he'll draw a connection between the anti-immigrant know-nothing party of that period and the rhetoric we hear coming from Donald Trump. He will also mention his signature achievement, that soda tax enacted to fund pre-kindergarten and other programs. His moment in front of 5,000 delegates.
I think we're going to have our moment again tonight, tomorrow night, and right through the convention. Thanks, Dave.
Great. Take care.
Now, even as the Democrats are hoping to talk up unity inside the center, outside in several locations citywide, protesters were making their voices heard in the heat. Thousands of followers of Bernie Sanders assembled around City Hall today. The Vermont senator is scheduled to speak at the convention this evening. 29-year-old Aaron Davis of Ohio says that he and his dad, a Navy veteran, got excited about Sanders, and that enthusiasm has not transferred to Clinton.
He has a record of doing the right thing. My father supports him. My father's a Navy veteran. So if my father and can agree on stuff like this, I like the guy.
Meanwhile, members of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign marched down Broad Street to the Wells Fargo Center this afternoon, an effort to raise awareness about poverty and homelessness. They were joined by thousands of supporters of Bernie Sanders and Green Party candidate Jill Stein. March organizer, longtime Philadelphia activist Sherry Honkala, says both the Republican and Democratic parties have failed to address these issues.
We're tired of Pepsi and Coke. We're going to look back on 2016, and we gave birth to independent politics in America.
Sherry Honkala organized a similar march in 2000 when Philadelphia hosted the RNC. 16 years on, Philadelphia's poverty rate has risen by roughly 5%. Across the river in Camden, Occupy DNC held a rally at City Hall before marching over the Ben Franklin Bridge into Philadelphia. Edna Davis mistakenly thought the rally was a Black Lives Matter rally. She supports Hillary, so obviously she didn't intend to go to a rally full of Bernie supporters. She took the opportunity to debate Sanders fan Cynthia Correa from New Brunswick.
He's turned his back on her. You do not need this separation. You don't need Donald Trump in there.
Okay, but you're assuming that Hillary honestly won the primary. We are here for November and far beyond because our issues, all the foreclosures, all the imprisonment, all the criminalization of minor drug possession, all the lobbying of the NRA.
Right now, I think you support Hillary's and put her in, and then y'all can fight for what y'all want. You're going to get it.
In addition to protesters, politicians, delegates, and plenty of media are in town this week. There will be daytime events in Center City, evening events in South Philly, and parties everywhere in between. But what visitors won't likely see is that Philly is home to neighborhoods that make it the poorest big city in the nation. How did that happen? WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports.
In the middle of Westmoreland Street in North Philly is a red row home with steep stone steps. In the mid-1940s, Dolores Harris and her family lived here before moving around the corner and eventually out completely.
It was my grandmother, grandfather, and my great-grandmother, and two aunts, and then a father, mother, and four kids.
Harris says the neighborhood was like one big family. They looked out for one another, even watched big boxing matches together.
Joe Louis was fighting, and everybody was on our steps and in our house.
Things changed as 1960 crept closer. A lot of the factories that dotted the neighborhood were either declining or gone. Soon, there were fewer homeowners, more renters. The jobs weren't there to keep people around long.
You know, it's just like one drops off, and then another drops off, and then one day you look up, and a lot of the people that I knew were not there.
Harris's story partially explains why Philadelphia is the poorest big city in the country, says Temple University professor Judith Levine. Even those without a high school diploma could earn a good living.
One needed a strong back or dexterous fingers and or just willingness to stand on your feet all day long and do tedious work. And if you did that, most people got a living wage and there was some job stability.
As factories packed up for bigger, cheaper spaces in the suburbs or overseas, Levine says neighborhoods started decaying.
And what's replaced it is this industry that requires not just some education, but a lot of education. So the healthcare industry and the higher education industry requires a lot of education. Our educational system is in disarray. It's underfunded, and our population is not highly educated.
But there are other factors. So-called white flight did a lot of damage, too. It concentrated poverty in the city. Robert Chaskin teaches classes on urban poverty and social policy at the University of Chicago. He says some of that phenomenon was fueled by the real estate industry. He says realtors use scare tactics to drive out white working class families. This happened in Philly and also other major urban hubs around the country as more and more African Americans moved from the rural South to the North.
Making the case that this neighborhood is about to change, you know, black people are going to move in, your property values are going to go down, you should get out while you can. And so they were able to, particularly in these sort of work-class homeowner neighborhoods, sort of purchase these properties at relatively low prices and then turn around and rent them.
At the same time, banks made it difficult or impossible for African Americans living in certain areas to get loans, mortgages, and other financial services. Redlining was officially outlawed in the 1970s, but its impact is still being felt today, says Chaskin. Which brings us to 2016. Roughly one quarter of Philadelphians live in poverty, and roughly half of them are living in what's called deep poverty. That means earning less than half of the federal poverty line. For a single parent with two children, we're talking about roughly $10,000 a year. These figures are bad, but just a few years ago, they were actually worse. During the height of the Great Recession, Philadelphia's poverty rate was 28%. What changed? Temples Levine says the city's population has grown steadily since then, every year. And the people moving in, a lot of them aren't living in poverty. Many are young professionals.
And so they are diluting the poverty rate because they're part of the denominator of the population of the city, and they're not part of the numerator of people in poverty.
In other words, Philadelphia still has roughly the same number of people living in poverty. Levine also sees some silver linings. She's encouraged by the city's new mayor, Jim Kenney, and his commitment to addressing poverty. But she thinks the city will be dealing with the same issues 10, even 20 years from now, in part because it can take multiple generations to break the cycle of poverty, and there's not enough being done to shrink it. Back in North Philly, Dolores Harris heads towards her car to return to her new home. She lives in Chestnut Hill now, one of the city's wealthiest neighborhoods. Talking to her, you get the sense there's a twinge of guilt that she left 19th and Westmoreland behind, and that others have too.
We keep running. Where are we running to? You know, what's going to be the ultimate? Because at some point, we're not going to be able to run anymore, you know. If we have a problem here, does anybody stop to think about, let's fix this problem, and then maybe we'll have to run?
But what Harris calls running often gets called moving up. And one of Philadelphia's biggest challenges is to help people out of poverty while also working to ensure longtime residents in gentrifying neighborhoods don't get pushed out so people can move up without feeling they have to move out. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Still ahead this evening, in a year of racially charged rhetoric, the head of the NAACP has words for both candidates, but especially Donald Trump.
You can't govern by generality or platitude. You got to govern with specifics. You got to know what you're talking about. We're calling upon them, certainly Mr. Trump, to spell it out.
Stay with our live NewsWorks Tonight broadcast from the DNC. We'll be back after this break. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller, live at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. The primetime speeches won't start for another couple of hours, though for many delegates, action got underway this morning with breakfast featuring speakers and dignitaries. WHYY's Joe Hernandez stopped by the New Jersey delegation breakfast. That's where he caught up with NAACP President Cornell Williams Brooks. Joe started the conversation by asking what it's like to be the president of the NAACP at a time of such racial tension in America.
Well, it is a momentous moment in the country. It's a trying hour. And so when you consider the serial hashtag tragedies from Michael Brown through Tamir Rice, through Walter Scott, through Eric Garner, through Sandra Bland, when we see police officers being assassinated in our streets. This is a time of tragedy and tumult. It is also a moment in our country where millennials consider race relations to be at the very top of the agenda. And race is, generally speaking, the top non-economic issue before the country. And so this being the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protection of the Voting Rights Act, this is a critical moment because we as a country have a choice. We can walk backward in a regressive pace, or we can walk forward in a progressive manner. And in New Jersey, where you have 1.2 million people who are struggling to make ends meet, 4 out of every 10 New Jerseyans, you really need leadership both in the White House, in the state legislature, and certainly in the governor's mansion.
Why do you think race relations are so high right now? Why do you think it's such an item in the news? I mean, is it just an item in the news, or are things really getting worse?
No, I think it's a combination of a couple things. The fact that we've had 8 years, or nearly 8 years, of the presidency of the nation's first African-American commander-in-chief, there's a certain kind of reservoir of racial resentment. We have public servants and politicians exploiting racial anxieties in the midst of economic anxieties. We also have a generation of young people with technology such that they're able to record racial injustices at the hands of the police that have long been there but are now being recorded. And so where you have a Tamir Rice, being a 12-year-old boy being killed in the playground with less than 2 seconds of an assessment of his dangerousness, where you have Sandra Bland being detained in a routine traffic stop, ending up dead and being threatened with a taser as a consequence of her refusing to put out a cigarette. That's a pretty radical anti-smoking smoking cessation strategy.
What did you see from the Republicans in Cleveland, and what do you hope to see here in Philly from the Democrats?
What we noticed, or what we heard from Mr. Trump, was a message that focused on law and order with very little definition as to law and no detail with respect to order. We are looking for specificity, policy granularity. So in other words, where does he stand on community policing? Where does he stand on community review boards? Where does he stand on special prosecutors or collecting data so that we might know how bad the problem of policing in this country is? Because we want to be clear here. When you're elected to the highest office of our democracy, the most powerful person in the free world, you can't govern by generality or platitude. You got to govern with specifics. You got to know what you're talking about. We're calling upon them, certainly Mr. Trump, to spell it out.
NAACP President Cornell Williams Brooks speaking with WHYY's Joe Hernandez. With 7 locations around Center City, Philadelphia, Political Fest is part of the framework of events around the DNC to entertain delegates and to give the public a taste of the convention. WHYY's Mike and Scott reports.
Made for social media, photo opportunities beckon at the convention center's Political Fest location. You can get your picture taken stepping off a Kennedy-era model of Air Force One. You can pose in 1960s voting booths or answer the phone in a mock Oval Office. 18-year-old Giancarlo Lovano from Whitehall, Pennsylvania, had just gotten off Air Force One, and he said he came to have fun, but also to tap into something bigger.
I wanted to come here to be part of history. I think it's really cool that the Democrats are nominating a woman.
Jim Moore of Bucks County wore a Bernie T-shirt, but he says he's ready for the party to unite.
I certainly supported Bernie during the primaries, but I definitely think now's the time to sort of rally together behind the chosen candidate.
Margaret Ayeni of Philadelphia agrees. She says despite the controversy over leaked emails, the spirit at this and other convention events has been good.
People are very excited, and they are happy people. You can just see their faces lighting up.
And by the way, if the battery on your phone runs out from putting all those presidential pictures on Instagram, you can recharge it at Political Fest, but you have to create your own energy by pedaling on a bike. I'm Mike and Scott, WHYY News.
And that's a wrap on our NewsWorks Tonight broadcast. Do stay with us, though, for NPR coverage of the Democratic National Convention starting tonight at 8. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. We'll be broadcasting here right through Thursday night, so join us this week for many more interviews and voices from the convention and around Philadelphia. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.